Hola y bienvenidos a todos al podcast, Efi.
Hola y bienvenidos a todos al podcast, Efi.
There we go. Do you feel more integrated?
Yeah, I do. That really makes me feel so welcome. Thank you, guys. What do you think of my
Spanish accent then? I've been working on for several seconds.
I think it sounds brilliant. I mean, if you're in the northern of England, northern of England, you get by really easy.
With that. Those Mexicans from Cumbria will really appreciate what I'm doing.
They will really understand what you mean. Dos cervezas, por favor. Do you understand? That sort of thing, yeah.
Excellent.
That's brilliant. Brilliant Spanish.
What a great start. So this is Season 3, Episode 16 of the Tux Radar Podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
I'm Jonathan Roberts.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Wonderful. In this episode, we'll be talking about Google acquiring Motorola Mobility, Linus Torvalds ditching GNOME 3. We've got our discoveries, the results of You Dare Us making a Linux box for shops, Speak Your Brains, and of course, the open ballot. If/when you love this podcast, you will love also Linux Format Magazine, 130 odd pages of Linux awesomeness every month, and you can subscribe for a bargain price at tuxradar.com/subscribe. So without further ado, let's get straight into the news. And the biggest event is that Google has acquired Motorola Mobility for a very cool $12.5 billion.
Awesome. Yeah. I think it's really good news for Android. Yeah. Maybe not so good news for other Android platforms, but I think probably in the long run it will be, because Google now has a big investment in the actual hardware platform. It has a lot of patents, but most importantly, I think the biggest problem with Android is fragmentation. This will create a de facto Android suite of devices that Google will guarantee run apps in just the same way that Apple has.
Yes, and presumably without all these extra additions on top, I can't imagine they'll be adding Moto Blur and all that
now.
They want a vanilla.
They've done a brilliant job with Android, and hopefully they'll just, you know, they've worked with HTC to create many of their designs, and I'm sure, you know, it'll happen with the Mobility series as well. And I think it's great news. Great news for Google.
Yeah, well, they say they want to, this will enable Google to supercharge the Android ecosystem.
Wow.
Sounds cool.
It's their biggest acquisition, isn't it?
Is it really?
I think so.
12 billion?
Yeah.
What did they buy YouTube for?
Yeah.
That was quite expensive.
75 pence. I don't know. But I think it is. But it's interesting that, you know, where the world is going, what with Apple becoming the biggest company in the world, it's mostly mobile technology. You know, it's a good pointer, I think.
Don't understand how Apple have become, like, it's somewhere
bigger than Exxon.
Because, I mean, they have, what, maybe 20% of the smartphone market share. They have maybe 10% of the desktop market.
It's profits, I guess.
Well, just the amount of... Do they even give out a dividend, though? I don't know that Apple give a dividend to their shareholders. I don't understand.
They're just saving up vast amounts of money.
Yeah, ready to build
reason.
Their own private army. I heard they have a laser in space.
Yeah, Steve Jobs controls.
Well, in fact, those people in the Apple store are drones, aren't they? So they just get the signal and they'll all start walking around our streets going, gil, gil, gil.
Why would no Apple stores hit during the riots in London?
And that's true.
This is true because that's where you would break into.
Yeah,
one.
I mean,
not
if
I
was
know
writing,
anything
yeah.
about rioting.
Waterstones and Apple are in it together.
Got to say, but with I can only think that Google buying Motorola, it's got to be good for consumers at least, because it means that if Google put out a whole range of quality plain vanilla Android devices without rubbishy skins on top of it, it's going to show up all the bad skins that all the other manufacturers are putting out, and they're going to have to respond by putting out decent Android devices that are updated regularly and are going to keep pace with what Google do with Motorola.
Yeah.
So it is going to make the whole platform better, provided it doesn't go under in a snowball of patent lawsuits and GPL violations.
That's the other thing, that they've, in buying Motorola, they've also bought loads and loads of patents.
Yeah.
Which will be used to, you know, in trade-offs to stop Microsoft suing them and all sorts of stuff. It should grease
Apple
the wheels.
Suing them.
It should just, you know, help things go a lot better in the future.
Hopefully.
And it means Google is heavily invested in making sure that Android works, succeeds against those patent lawsuits. Which I think is important, because they, at the moment, they've not actually been directly affected. by any of the lawsuits because they've been going after but now they've become a handset manufacturer.
Probably gives them more scope to fight in court as well, because I know Apple did a similar thing with for independent developers who were getting sued for patent infringement. Apple bought a stake at least in some companies to give them a direct stake in the lawsuit so they could defend directly rather than just being a friend.
Was that the Lodsis business?
Yeah, the
Lodsis. Yeah. It's two L's and it must be Welsh.
Lodsis.
That Welsh patent troll that everybody's so scared of, yeah.
Alan Cox. he's not Welsh.
Talking of kernel developers...
I know he's not Welsh before we get people making guides. He speaks very good Welsh, though.
Yes, he does, doesn't he? Talking of kernel developers, Linus Torvalds has ditched GNOME 3 for XFCE, calling it an unholy mess.
I love Linus.
Please allow me to read out. I could try a Linus Torvalds accent.
Is it a press release in the style of some big company that's all jargon and mincing words and talk about leveraging data silos and such gibberish?
No, does he worry about people flaming him for his opinion?
No, it's Linus Torvalds, so it includes the word crap. As we expect. So this is what he said. This is what he posted on Google+, interestingly. He said, in GNOME 3, the developers have apparently decided that it's too complicated to actually do real work on your desktop and have decided to make it really annoying to do. Here's an example of the crazy. You want a new terminal window, so you go to activities and press the terminal thing that you've made part of your normal desktop thing. But why can't I actually have it on the desktop instead of that insane activities? What happens? Nothing. It brings your existing terminal to the forefront. That's just crazy crap. Now I need to use Shift-Control-N in an old terminal to bring up a new one. Yeah, that's a real user experience improvement, sure.
Yeah.
Sarcasm always goes down so well.
I'm quite surprised he even tried it in the first place. I assume by now Linus Torvalds wouldn't even bother updating latest desktops. He'd just run like FBWM and that's it.
Right. Well, he quite publicly moved from KDE to GNOME, didn't he? And so he's probably just been stuck with GNOME ever since, and then his Ubuntu installation automatically upgraded and he was like, oh, what's this?
So Linus Torvalds is a clueless user who doesn't keep an eye on his upgrades.
It's good that Linus states his opinion. I really admire that in him. It's something that we've all said for a long time, and it's something that the community has been saying in a lot of numbers. I don't know. I mean, we've been here before with KDE. I'm sure in a couple of years' time, it'll work out for GNOME 3.
See, I always thought Linus Torvalds would be the best person to sort out desktop fragmentation, because he could simply say you're not allowed to use the word Linux anywhere in your product unless you just use this desktop and this library and this. And then, you know, it just say, right, that's it. All Linux products have to use XFCE. And suddenly we get a huge amount of desktop consolidation because all these products that wanted to ride on the name Linux wouldn't be able to use all these fragmented desktops
anymore. Choice is such a good thing, Mike.
Oh, it's great. It's like breakfast cereals, isn't it?
I spent 5 minutes walking up. I actually spent 5 minutes walking up and down the breakfast cereal aisle yesterday at Sainsbury's, just trying to figure out which one I wanted.
Right.
Overwhelmed.
So when you multiply that by computer operating systems, which require a lot of investment.
And desktop environments,
On Wikipedia, I found something really cool.
Wait for discovery of the week, surely.
Okay.
Just don't restrict this guy.
Let him fly.
Sorry, Andrew.
Okay, listeners, stay on tenterhooks in a state of elevated excitement.
Isn't that called a lead? Like
until discovery of the week.
That you hook the listeners with some tease of what's coming.
That's a great idea.
We should do that more. Yeah. Coming up, some great stuff. Stay tuned.
That's so accidentally professional.
I'm listening now. I'm waiting.
Yeah, I don't want to do the rest of the news. Can we just go straight on?
So until XFCE version, you know, mega 5-point brilliant comes out and with an all new desktop paradigm, presumably Linus will just stick with XFCE because it works and it works well.
Yeah, usually what happens is the desktops get bigger, so somebody launches a lighter one. So XFCE was in response to GNOME, and then LXDE was in response to XFCE. And the cycle will just go on forever, and people will keep redesigning paradigms when we could just make something that works. And then,
I'm sure I heard, I think it was a Slashdot comment saying, what's Linus Torvalds going to do when XFCE goes bad? And someone said, well, he wrote his own kernel, and then he wrote his own source code management system, so maybe next he's going to write his own desktop environment.
Yeah, so, or just use a cross-compiler on a Mac, probably.
Or Motif. That'll be what it is. He only needs one window. But it also means you win, doesn't it?
Yeah, because I'm an XFCE user, and the only XFCE user on our team.
We should have an Olympic flame of desktops. I had it for a while when Linus used KDE.
Yeah.
And then, well, Paul used GNOME, didn't he?
He did.
And John's still using GNOME 3.
Yeah. I say that slightly derogatorily.
Like, I didn't mean it to be.
What's he doing? Why?
No, I think it's brilliant that you're using it. I can see why you do. I really mean that.
I respect masochists as well. Yeah.
So the talk is now handed to you, Mike.
Great. Okay, then.
In that case, I'm switching to LXDE.
You know what's coming for the inevitable switch over.
Next up in the news, KDE5 is in development, and there are plans for KDE Frameworks 5.0. So I'll leave this one to Graham.
I have absolutely no idea.
Well, then let's move on.
The little I've read about it or seen about it, we're not going to see any changes on the desktop. They're just going to develop new libraries, mostly to improve the mobile space, in parallel to KDE4.
Yeah, it's going to be evolutionary, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that means that it won't be like KDE4 where they're going to change anything. It'll just be a way of providing new APIs to use on a mobile. And also, I mean, Qt5 is due out next year. I mean, there was an Nokia made the announcement in May. So I imagine part of KDE5's motivation is to keep parity with version numbers of Qt.
You now say Qt instead of Qt. Right. What's happened?
Well, Qt is my common sense approach.
Right.
And Qt is my bullied into it by everybody out there on the internet approach.
When you go to the Qt conferences in that wonderful place in Munich, does everybody there say Qt?
Yeah, they do.
They do. So
and
you come back.
They laugh at you if you say Qt.
Really?
They go,
you're
what?
They pretend not to understand.
So, Gnome, Gnome. I actually tried to say Gnome the other day to someone, and I actually said Gnome, and they were like, what's that? I forget that I'm in this weird world of pronunciation.
Linux, Linux.
Yeah.
And lastly, Firefox 6 has been released.
Oh, excellent. Brilliant.
After 3 minutes after version 5. The highlights here are the awesome bar now colours in domain names. It highlights them just like Chrome does.
Awesome.
And there's a scratch pad for trying out JavaScript code.
Oh, that's a really cool idea.
But this is my favourite feature, actually, a new one, is plugin check. Check that your plugins are up to date. How about not breaking compatibility all the time?
No, we've been here.
I read another Slashdot story about this, and people were saying, I can't deploy in my business. Firefox keeps breaking all the time, my plugins. And Firefox said, oh, it's your responsibility. Imagine if Microsoft had broken compatibility with DOS programs every time and said, well, you've got to check if they're working. It would never have got that success. They have got to learn. You know, compatibility and binary compatibility in the Linux world is a foreign idea for some reason. But this is especially bad, and people are just going to go to Chrome where your plugins don't break and your extensions don't break.
Is this the version that you were saying yesterday you can't find the version number of?
I've read that. That might be this version, or it's a plan. I read about this on Slashdot as well.
It's still in the about dialogue, I think.
No, it's not in the about dialogue. It just says whether you've got the newest or not.
That's a plan to do that, I think.
Right.
But it's not been implemented yet.
Right.
According to that's what I read this morning.
That's their plan. So you can phone up technical support and they'll say, what version have you got? I don't know. people are abandoning it left, right, and centre. I've seen so many comments on Slashdot. People saying, I've taken out my business now. I need a browser that has a version number and that is stable. And so that's it. I mean, you know, the most successful flagship open source project, and they're killing themselves.
It's weird times, because doesn't Mozilla have to renegotiate its default search engine terms in October or something like that, where 98% of its income comes from Google? If that somehow falls through, or they try and squeeze them to move to Bing or something like that, and if it all moves to Bing, then we'll all it's easy to change, you know.
That won't be good.
They're losing a lot of goodwill.
They really are. It's quite surprising. It wouldn't surprise me if they backtrack or it gets forked or something.
Well, I can see what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I still don't understand how distributions are supposed to support this as well, long-term distros like Debian.
Yes.
When it's jumping, Debian only wants to apply patches to a program, not add new features. Whereas Firefox changing the user interface all the time, breaking compatibility in a kind of almost a kind of frenzy. I don't get it.
I think you're right now. When we talked about it before, that there should be a stable branch at least that gets patched with fixes. And
yeah,
that's it.
An LTS version at least. Yeah. Then that's fine what they're doing now. Yeah. Cool, go nuts, get the latest technologies.
Compete with Chrome, but at the same time, don't abandon the enterprise.
Yeah, say Firefox 5 is going to be supported with just bug fixes and security patches for the next 18 months.
It's now time for Discovery of the Fortnite, which has been really good Fortnite.
What happened? Oh, there were some riots, weren't there? Yeah, I was too busy.
I went away.
Oh, yeah.
Had a few days on the beach. That's it was cold.
That's Britain.
Found various parts of crabs washed up in the pools on the beach.
Yeah. Any jellyfish?
Yeah, actually, there are some dead jellyfish washed up there.
It's nice. It's always good to see.
Yeah.
They're all dead.
They were all dead. Do they still sting you when they're dead?
Yeah.
I think so. I didn't try it.
Yeah. Don't try this at home, kids.
That could have been my discovery had I been stung. Does anyone want to go first?
I'll go first.
Oh, cool. Thanks, Sean.
This relates to my suggestion for next fortnight or months. You dare ask. But anyway, apparently there is an open 802.11s project, which is now in the mainline kernel and perhaps has been since like 2.6.26 or something.
Right.
And it's basically, mesh networking is now incorporated into the mainline kernel, which is really cool because mesh networking has all sorts of great uses in the developing world for OLPC laptops. It has all sorts of uses with FreedomBox for establishing networks.
What's mesh networking?
So mesh networking is when, rather than having a central router or hub that it connects to, devices connect directly to one another and route your signal around the network without needing to go to any centralized point to do it. So it's really clever and apparently a very hard problem to solve. But it's cool that there's now a solution in the mainline kernel.
That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Because then you can be quite far away from a big central tower, a big broadcast tower, a great big...
I mean, the idea with OLPC, I don't know if it ever worked out in production, was that the mesh network... there would be a centralized like internet connection hub in the school, and then the children's computers would create a mesh network. So if you were out of range of the school where you lived, you'd connect to other OLPCs and you'd gradually get routed to the network.
That's excellent.
That was the original idea. I don't think it worked out in the end because it's a hard problem to solve. But now that there's a solution in the mainline kernel, it's going to get a lot of attention. It's going to make a lot of progress. And it's got all kinds of excellent, you know, potential deployment situations and whatnot. So
that's
really
cool. That's a really good discovery.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, actually, I would like mesh networking in cars. Because I think, especially when there's bad traffic, if there's bad traffic on the motorway 50 miles ahead of you, what you want is for all the cars in front to be communicating with one another so that news can travel back to all the cars.
Oh, I thought you meant for like watching YouTube while you're driving.
No, but that would be but I actually mean in terms of congestion and how busy the roads are.
It'd be an intelligent road network, which apparently they're doing a lot with mobile phones now. Like, so you can get applications for your mobile phone that will report on your moving speed and stuff and share that information across all the users of that application so it can detect where jams are.
Well, Google Maps is actually really good for traffic congestion.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is that how it does it?
I don't know how it does it, but we were driving down the M5 a couple of weeks ago to the beach.
Right.
There had been 5 or 6 hours of delays at certain junctions.
Yeah.
So we'd left late, seeing that this was a problem. But as we drove down, I had Google Maps on my phone. When we encountered an area where there was no congestion, yet Google Maps showed there was congestion, as soon as we approached that area, Google Maps switched to green, showing there was no congestion.
So that was you doing
that. And maybe assuming that it knew how fast we were going 70 on the motorway, there was no congestion. We updated Google's.
That's excellent.
So maybe that's what they do, but I don't actually know how they work.
I mean, all the data collection stuff and what is a bit uncomfortable.
Scary.
But at the same time, it's
But if you do nothing wrong, what are you afraid of? When they turn evil, it's going to be awesome.
Skynet.
But between Google and Apple's private army with their $70 billion in cash...
Is the door just locked?
What's that? I actually looked.
What's that odourless gas coming down?
No! The steel shutters.
Brilliant, thanks, John.
I've got
yes. Awesome, thanks, Effie.
My discovery is related to the sort of...
subject that you were touching earlier on. It's about car, Linux and the car industry. And Toyota just sorry about that. Toyota just joined as a gold member of the Linux Foundation, and they invest in loads and loads of
Who's
money.
Just joined?
Toyota.
Toyota.
Yeah.
Cool.
And well, how do you say Toyota? Toyota. I say Toyota. Is that?
Let's start a car company called Toyota.
Toyota. How will they say it in Japan? You've been to Japan.
Toyota.
Toyota.
I know.
Okay. Them.
Did you hear that, listeners?
Is that in my head?
No. That's real.
We're free.
It's a promotional video from
the Rapture.
Anyway, Toyota has joined the Linux Foundation, and they invest in lots of money in the development of Linux to be used in car dashboards, which basically relates to what you were talking about, the whole communication and car system, automated car systems. And I think it's a brilliant idea because the gadgets that they're using are basically like mobile phones, have touch screens.
Yeah.
I think it's Navisat, I think it's called the
GPS.
Yeah, the GPS, that one. But it's completely Linuxed, kernel based.
There's a version of Migo for in-car systems.
That would be then. Probably that's
It might even be Migo. In fact, that's a good future for Migo.
But yeah. I always was wondering, because all the new cars, well, I'm probably too old to be talking about cars.
Really, what, 57?
67. The good old cars, they were all mechanics. You didn't have to rely on the computerized. It
started them with a crank.
Exactly. Yeah. Push them.
Someone had to walk.
Push
them.
Push start them. But now it's a difficult thing to fix a car because of the computerized system on them. But now everything is going to be probably easier because you will be in complete control of the system of your car, more or less.
If you could flash your... I was going to say it'd be cool if you could flash your computer in your car, but maybe that would be a bad idea.
I've got Gen 2 running. Smash. Do you think Toyota will send us a review copy of one of these cars then? It's 30 Monmouth Street, Bath, A1, 2BW.
Let's do it.
Let's ask them, yeah.
Well, that was one discovery. The other discovery was that yesterday I had the pest control in our new house to come and kill... to destroy a wasp nest.
Oh, right. And I wonder what you were going to say. That's not so bad.
No, it's nice.
My children.
And contrary to popular belief, wasps do go through really harsh winters. Most people, apparently, this guy was telling me, most people believe that the colder the winter is, the worse it is for wasps. They don't die.
They don't care.
They survive. They hibernate and then... apparently, the colder the winter is, the better the spring is for them. There's more food. So if you believe that because the weather is really, really cold because of hard winter, and you got wasp nests in your house and they're going to die because of the cold, don't think that. Because it's not going to happen. They're just going to multiply the following spring.
It's like the alien in Aliens.
Exactly.
You think it's gone. But no, it can actually survive in a vacuum.
And that's it. That was my two discoveries.
Thanks, Effie. Not a bad contribution.
I thought I'd give something to society.
Something public health related.
Looks like Andrew's going to speak.
Everybody get ready.
Oh.
That thing I found, I've just remembered that I spoke about it earlier in a previous discovery of the
month. Oh no! So anticlimactic.
It's still quite cool though. It's called, I can't remember whether it's, I think it's called Japanese tourist syndrome.
I remember you mentioning it.
But John wasn't here, so you know, it's worth repeating. Because loads of tourists come from Japan to London. It's obviously a long way, so they've had to save up for quite a long time, and they're really looking forward to it. And when they get here, there's something like 5 or 10% of people who just get overwhelmed by the choice think there's just too much. What do I do? Do I look at the London Eye, or do I go to the Tower of London, and then, or do I go to Buckingham Palace, and then just get really stressed and start to hyperventilate and
really
and faint and things?
Yeah. That actually happens.
It's an observable phenomenon.
So if I walk around London, I should see lots of passed out Japanese people on the pavement.
Well, they'll probably be back in the coach or in the hotel.
Right. Yeah, I've read about this actually happening in Paris as well, that Japanese tourists go there and they spend a huge amount of money coming from the other side of the planet, and all they've done is look at a few pictures of the centre of the city, and then they actually go around and they see there's quite a lot of dirt and rundown stuff around Paris, and they're like, they get really, really depressed then, and they have to have counselling and stuff like that.
Shall I do my discovery? Mine isn't a massive discovery. I'm still in a retro games mode. You know, I talked about Exalt, the Ultima 7 engine, last time. Well, this time I've discovered that a game that I've talked about in the past called Lords of Midnight, which is by Mike Singleton from the 80s. He developed it for the Spectrum. Mike Singleton is an awesome hero of mine. In fact, Hugh corrected me by telling me that Morkin was the name that I'd been looking for in the podcast. But anyway, Lords of Midnight is being recreated by a guy called Chris Wilde, who actually reverse engineered Lords of Midnight back in the early 90s and created a PC version. He started off creating an iOS version, but he's using something called the AirPlay SDK, which means he will be creating a Linux version. But most amazingly, Mike Singleton's got in touch with him. And in fact, the two of them are actually working together to create Lords of Midnight with improvements.
Cool.
And then they're going to write the third episode, which was never released, of Lords of Midnight, Doom Dark's Revenge, and then they're going to do the third one.
Oh.
And I think that's amazing. That's just brilliant. I just hope they don't screw it up.
No pressure.
No, because they're already changing things because of the way that Lords of Midnight worked. It kind of rendered planes of graphics to give the impression of depth, and now they're putting it in a 3D environment and it's got smooth scrolling. So Chris Wilde's blog is actually very interesting. It's a semi kind of diary about the kind of challenges they're facing updating a game from 1984 or whenever it was to this new AirPlay SDK. I can't wait for the next version.
And if David Braben is listening...
Well, funnily enough, that's what my discovery is about as well, because I've discovered a remake of a classic game.
Yeah.
This is called Pioneer, the Pioneer Space Simulator, and it's actually an open source remake of Frontier.
Really?
Now, before we all explode, this is still in quite early days, but...
He's got Pioneer by... as a title screen.
10 print Pioneer. No, it's actually, you can fly around and hyperspace, and the controls are the same as Frontier, and it's got all these planets. It's got some rough parts to it at the moment, but wow. I just discovered this on the Frontier forums out of nowhere. And it's really, really impressive. Unfortunately, it's about a 200 megabyte download because
Why?
Of all the textures and music.
It's actually got WAV files for the music.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you know, given that Frontier fit into like 800K. But it's really, really impressive. The website says it bears a sneaking resemblance to Frontier, but it's pretty much just entirely inspired by Frontier.
So he's not reverse engineering it at all? He's kind of...
No, they're just writing a new game from scratch with like parts of it in Lua, I think, and stuff like that. So... but, you know, just Frontier fans who love the game so much have thought enough is enough.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Braben won't release the source code. He won't cooperate, like you were saying about that guy.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So, you know, hopefully, perhaps in another year, 2 years, we'll end up with a highly portable, open source version of Frontier. That'd be the best thing on the planet.
It would be.
You can play on your Android phone.
Yes. Yeah.
What would we do? What would we do with our real lives?
The magazine wouldn't happen anymore.
Yeah. No.
So stop working on it, Pioneer people, please. Yeah. And with such Braben-hating fun, we come to the halfway point of this podcast. Still to come, the You Dare Us results, Speak Your Brains, and of course, the Open Ballot.
Great. So now it's time for You Dare Us. And our dare for this fortnight was to... Andrew's doing it now. To draw your own... To come up with a box for Linux if it was going to be marketed on shelves in a shop. Whichever distro you like. Anyone want to go?
Sure, I'll go first, shall I? Well, when we mentioned packaging, the best bit of packaging I can think of is actually that comes with a McDonald's Happy Meal. So... This is my idea for a box. It's like a big Happy Meal box, but with tucks on it.
Right. Does it have a toy inside?
Well, that would be excellent, like with a drawstring and...
Yeah.
And it just makes you happy. It's Linux.
Is there any proof that Happy Meals make people happy?
Yeah, I've seen the adverts. Have you not seen the little children running around?
With that clown?
Yeah.
It probably causes more damage.
They love that Happy Meal box.
Allegedly. Yeah. As part of a calorie-controlled diet, McDonald's is perfectly healthy.
So that's my box.
That's cool.
It's okay.
My box. I decided not to go with any particular distro and decided to go for the freedom issue. So it's a box with some big text that says, "Hello, here is your freedom back." And then in smaller text, "Inside this box is a complete, secure, shareable operating system with hundreds of programs. You own it." I thought it'd be better to take that approach than to say, wow, this is Fedora Ubuntu X or Linspire.
The only problem with that is it looks a little bit like a cereal box.
I was going to say that.
Ah, right, yeah.
Which one is better?
What would you do?
So I really like the way you've done the angled text.
Yeah, I use the GIMP's perspective tool to do that.
It's pretty cool. It's very clever.
It is
which,
cool.
You know, I made a layer and then I moved it around and stuff.
You've had a lot of work to buy.
Between 5 and 10 minutes. Yeah, so there we go.
Andrew?
It's a penguin with a strange face.
It's a penguin with a strange face.
Looks like a cross between a penguin and a 12-year-old child.
Yeah, because I can't really draw penguins.
Since when did penguins have hair like that anyway? You could have just left it bald.
In retrospect, probably I should have done.
So what's your goal there? What are you saying? What's your statement with that box?
Well, it's quite amateurish.
just like Lena.
Hastily cobbled together. Seriously, I've not given it an awful lot of thought, and I apologise. My relative inaction mocks the fine efforts that you two have put in.
Cool. I think we win.
We've not seen John's yet.
That's true. Effie's just scribbled something on a piece of paper, so...
Yeah, no, I didn't do it because I wasn't in the office. I was at the last podcast anyway, and I've been finishing the house, but I just came up with an idea.
You've been working on your house?
I nearly finished. Wow. I nearly finished. The cap is already down, so...
Amazing.
I haven't mentioned it yet.
Congratulations. I know.
Oh, no, I did mention it with a wasp net thing. Sorry about that. This is my nature. I thought, like, you know, the Kinder Surprise.
Toy and some chocolate.
That, but with a USB stick.
That's brilliant.
Linux Surprise.
It's really
good. That's great. Yeah. You don't know what distro you'll get. Yeah.
You'll buy it and you'll get Gen 2 and cry.
Yeah. Viva Mexico. Yeah. There you
go. That's brilliant. So cool.
Yeah. I really like that idea.
Really good. Mine is not a box. It's a card that you'd get, like maybe A5 rather than A4. And
or a business
card. And it's got your business card, and it's got a QR code on it, and it just has the name of the distro at the top, and it says, "This card provides a link to download Arch Linux or whichever distro, access to our excellent guides, and a lifetime of updates to improve performance and increase security." And then you buy it, and you get the QR code, and you take it home, and you download your distro, and you get it installed and follow the guides, and you do it yourself, and it's up to date. And
I've always wondered what people who've never seen a QR code before think when it is.
Like, it's a bit like a barcode.
What is it?
It's like a barcode.
this is your test to find out.
What does it do?
You scan it with your phone. You take a photo of it with your phone. And that one will probably send you to the Wikipedia mobile page, because that's where I got it from.
Yeah.
And your phone can take out a lot more information than a usual barcode. So it can have a URL, or it can have... Well, often it has a URL, so you get redirected to a web page to find out more about it.
And can all phones scan these?
No.
Smartphones.
Some smartphones can. You need... Yeah, most modern smartphones can probably do it. But
presumably as well, a computer with a webcam, you could write some software to do it as well.
So my non-smartphone...
But if you sat at the computer, you could just type in a URL.
Yeah, so we could just write the URL.
Yeah, I do like them. I mean, they're convenient. I think it's a really good idea.
Mm.
So I think it was Betfred or Paddy Power or some other betting company, but they're putting QR codes on the girls' bikini bottoms in the...
In the volleyball.
Beach volleyball. For the Olympics or something or other.
How are you meant to get a photo of that?
Well, exactly.
Oh, buy them a drink.
Go on, Andrew.
a good point to leave it.
And that's the end of a podcast. Okay, well, enough about QR codes. We need a UDAOAS. We're talking about this before coming down here this morning to do the podcast. And we were thinking that coming up with a box for Linux was maybe a bit naff.
Well, I tried so hard.
Me too.
That was a brilliant idea.
Yeah. That was really, yeah, Effie, was really good. Yeah, yeah, definitely Effie wins.
Right to whoever makes Kinder. What is it? That Swiss company. Is it?
Kinder?
Gringotts?
Nestle, isn't it?
Nestle.
Don't know.
Right. Well, let's find out.
Mm.
I hope to see that on the shelves soon.
I think there'll be a lot of disappointed children.
There's no chocolate.
Mummy, X server won't start.
So, before this podcast, we were talking about the fact that, yeah, designing your own box, not the best UDAOAS ever. So we were thinking that we need to do something a bit more real. And the reason we often don't do it when it's something a bit more real is because we are really busy putting the magazine together and we often run out of time. So I suggested that maybe rather than doing a UDAOAS every fortnight, we make it one a month and it gives us extra time to actually get the job done. And then we can attempt to do something cool and Linuxy. And maybe update you on our progress in the interim week, which will be kind of a kick up the backside when we've done nothing.
Yeah. We'll have to make up our progress, yeah.
And in our progress report, if we don't have enough time, we can always reintroduce the hot seat Graham volunteered earlier.
Yeah, Graham's going to talk about KDE again.
There's too much choice.
KDE 5 is a new desktop paradigm. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a good idea. It did inadvertently happen when we were really rubbish on our big project.
Doing it every month. Well, we can try.
I think it happened with the games one, didn't it?
That was by far the most ambitious one.
Yeah.
Programming a full game.
My suggestion for this month is that we try and set up a mesh network. It's in the kernel.
But all I've got is an Android phone.
Maybe
I don't have any hardware.
Yes.
I don't have a laptop.
Oh, maybe we won't be able to do that.
I've got a little laptop you can borrow.
Cool.
I don't know what the hardware requirements and stuff are for it, if it supports everything. I should have researched this better before suggesting it.
If we all have to compile leading-edge kernels.
No, it's a good idea.
It's been in since 0.26.
Try it, and then if it works, we could write about it. So
yeah.
It's almost not a complete waste of a morning.
Well, you've got a laptop, haven't you?
Yeah.
I've got a couple of, or two or three USB wireless things we could probably plug into your computer and my computer to make them wireless.
Yeah. Well, my Linux box. Yeah, I don't know what kernel that's got in it. I don't want to trash it too much.
Okay.
Build machine for disks,
sure, yeah, so. Okay.
So can I use my mobile phone?
I'll bring my netbook.
Probably not use your mobile phone.
Okay. No.
So just put
proper. Yeah. You could do it from a live CD, Mike.
Yeah, that's true.
You could run a live
CD. We can get enough machines together. Yeah.
We can give it a go.
Yeah, okay.
Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah.
So we're going to try and build our own mesh network. Excellent. Yeah.
Okay.
I hope this works, because it'd be cool.
What would the range be?
Well, I suppose what is the range of wireless of Wi-Fi anyway?
Don't know. 10 meters, 20 meters, depending. It depends on so many things.
So, like, presumably, if it's 20 meters, we could, as long as each person was within 20 meters of the next person, we could maybe extend it to 100 meters or so.
Can we do it by levels in the building?
Yeah,
or to the pub. We could,
yeah.
Line of us in the street.
Each pub along the path.
So that I can sit at the bar with a pint, browsing tokensradar.com.
While we're all compiling our kernels.
Yeah. Well, standing in the road.
Well, how do you prove it? You're going to have to video that, haven't you?
No. We can do a tutorial on it. We can say it worked. Talk about it.
We can say it worked.
Yeah. Whatever happens.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm excited about this.
Okay.
Cool. So we'll do that on the final day before after two podcasts.
Yeah.
Sounds cool.
Except we have to give a progress report in 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
We can try.
See what happens.
Yeah. Excellent.
Right then, let's get into Speak Your Brains. And we've got two really good ones this episode. Yeah.
That's not your normal introduction. Where you say, if you're going to send me really long emails.
With XML and C code in, then don't. But the first one here is quite critical, but it's from Who Hugh, who, our favourite guy. He says, I have 2 points I want to make. First of all, I recently switched to Debian Stable because I decided that bugs were more annoying than using old versions of software. But to my horror, I discovered that even Debian has its bugs. So ultimately, I decided that if I have to face bugs, no matter what distro I use, I may as well use a bleeding edge system anyway and settled on Arch Linux.
Yes, another one.
An Arch convert. And then he says, secondly, and this is an open rant to the free software community, when I encountered a bug in Debian, I had to jump through many hoops to submit the report. The crash handler required me to install GDB, then a load of debugging symbols, then reload it, then create an account with Bugzilla just to submit the bug. The instructions it gave to do all this failed several times, and I was left having to look up how to do it all. I'm a Linux veteran, and it was almost too much for me. How will someone much newer to Linux react when faced with that? I'm all for submitting bugs instead of just complaining on message boards, but that process was ridiculous, and the developers are probably getting far fewer reports than they might if the process was a lot easier.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Totally agree.
Yeah. I mean,
we've said it before, haven't we?
Yeah. I've seen on Windows and OS X, it's, you know, something will crash, but it will just say, click here to send it all straight to Microsoft or Apple, and you just let it be, and they'll work it out. And
yeah, there's lots of similar initiatives on Linux, but there isn't a single one, is there?
Yeah, there's not a single core. Yeah.
And I can't imagine it does any good. You know, when KWin crashes because of something and you click send, where does it go? You should be able to track it, shouldn't you? You should actually get a ticket number back.
You want to get reports telling you what's happening.
See if so somebody's...
It doesn't feel like it's just completely gone.
And then a much more positive message. This is a really good one. This is probably the best Speak Your Brains ever. This is from Stephen Sykes. He says, I'm a computer systems administrator for a science department in a university in Christchurch, New Zealand. When we experienced our February 22nd earthquake this year, we were not allowed back into our building for 3 months due to structural checks and repairs on buildings that needed doing around the campus. Naturally, not being able to get into your place of work is disruptive. On an existing CentOS 5 machine, I enabled off-campus remote access for all our students to our Windows lab computers so that they could use specialized software for their studies and staff the use of their office computers. This was done mostly with SSH tunnels and remote desktop and worked on Linux, Windows and macOS clients with some software I quickly knocked up to try and make it user-friendly. The system was very popular with staff and students and worked very well, and we still use it today. Meanwhile, the central IT department had trouble with their Windows terminal services not being able to handle the load of staff trying to use it. The old hand-built CentOS box I use with dual AMD Opteron CPUs and only 2 GB of RAM copes with multiple remote access logins, runs OpenVZ virtual machines, a web server, a file server, and does data acquisition as well, and it's not failed. The best thing is this solution costs no money to implement.
Yeah.
Thanks, Stephen. That's a really great uplifting story of Linux kicking ass in difficult times.
Yeah, fantastic. I can't follow that up.
Yeah. So if anybody else has used Linux in a massive disaster, catastrophe, then let us know.
But that is the valuable point on that email. It's the effort that he put on to solve the whole problem.
Yeah, but not just buying lots of software to fix the problem, but using Linux. So, yeah, please keep them coming, listeners. Email mike.saunders@futurenet.com with the subject line Speak Your Brains. Keep them fairly short, please, and we'll read out more in the next podcast.
Open ballot.
In which we ask, is Tux, the logo Tux, holding Linux back?
What, physically?
Well, I can't feel his fishy arms around me. So I don't think it's physically. I think it's more like stopping Linux from achieving all that it could possibly be. Well, the response from the internet is pretty clear. No, Tux is not holding Linux back.
It's the wrong answer.
Is it? Why are the people wrong? Why are the majority wrong, John?
You read first. And
okay. Mark Greeny says that as a logo, Tux is perfect, neat, bold and compact. It stands out well in the logo lineups, for example, in hosting adverts. Maybe staring at his ass rolling down a ski slope undermines this somewhat, so don't show Tux Racer to your CTO. compared to the paperclip, Paul S. says Tux is doing a great job. Compared to the paperclip, that silly dog and the spandex MS butterfly, I think Tux is respectable enough. And then maybe facetiously he adds, but no, you're right. The only reason that not everyone is using Plan 9 yet is because Glenda looks like a rabbit with myxomatosis. Glenda is a rabbit. Mike K says, the noble penguin can be made into a great logo, yes, but its standard Tux representation is just childish and cartoony. A couple of people have said that. One in reference to the Mandriva penguin, which looks really, really cool. Gregor W. says that in a scenario, there's a company needs another company to guarantee that a system works and provide support. But in that scenario, the distro will be branded by the company providing the distribution rather than with a generic penguin logo. So that's maybe analogous to Fujitsu Siemens supplying Microsoft computers to a local council rather than going straight to Microsoft.
Yeah.
So it's all branded with their stuff rather than the penguin. Here we go. Tux isn't much of a mascot, says too much free time. With Linux, each distro has a different symbol. Puppy Linux has a puppy. Ubuntu has three people holding hands to form a circle. And you can check Distro Watch for others. It's not clear to me how someone outside the Linux community knows to associate the Tux Penguin with Ubuntu or any other distro. Where would they have seen Tux? Until Tux gets branded on everything Linux, he isn't too much of a mascot. It's too easy to work with Linux and never see him.
Yeah, well, but you do see him around on, like, books. For instance, the Haynes Linux Manual. Really, really good.
That's a very
Linux
nice
book.
One, actually. How did they do that?
They got a penguin and put it on the Ubuntu logo. And it looks great. Excellent book. But, yeah, that's a big penguin on it. So people will see that. They go and look at the Linux books in a bookshop.
I've just found the Mandriva reference. That was from Sultan of Swing. But then he also says, the thing that bothers me most is that we as Linux users are asking the question, are we perhaps secretly embarrassed of Tux?
Secretly, I am a little bit embarrassed of Tux.
I'm not secretly embarrassed. Mike K is right, too cartoonish, says Pelican. He says, the Linux logo looks amateurish. I can't help but wonder if a better logo would attract more design-oriented users. Maybe then promised improvements to GIMP will happen within 2 years of them being announced. Maybe then Ubuntu's backgrounds won't always come off as both Apple imitating and lame. Maybe then video editing, yes, including the vaunted OpenShot, won't be so miserable, convoluted and borderline useless.
Ooh!
Yeah. Well, there you go. We've been thinking about in terms of adoption, but maybe features are impacted by the logo.
Well, I think John's going to put everyone in their place now.
I know. I was going to say, I think there's an important place for a logo for Linux, because despite what distributions would have you believe, hardware support in the different distributions comes down to the question of which kernel they're running, more or less, unless there's restricted drivers enabled, but increasingly that's not an issue. So having a logo that says this runs with Linux version 2.6.3.
Well, people aren't going to know that,
greater,
though, mostly.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think
it's helpful if there is a Linux logo on a box, because you know that somehow you can get it to work.
But also there's a possibility for it to be abused. Like, I've bought some printers in the past and stuff where you've had to download and go through horrendous steps to get the printer to work, and not through CUPS or any of the default systems.
But we can't blame Tux for that.
No, we can't blame Tux. But I don't really like Tux. I agree with the comments that say it's a bit too shiny, and someone made a great comment about him being small and fat and
smelling of fish
and insufferably smug, which is, I think, quite a fair description. I don't really like the way he looks.
I think it'd be good if we get to the point where it doesn't matter. I mean, you think, what does the AIX logo look like?
Yeah.
Does anyone know? People who are going out and buying AIX to run on gigantic, super powerful machines in the military and banks and stuff don't care what the logo looks like. They buy AIX.
I mean, for those people, though, that is the case. Like, there was a talk given by one of the Linux kernel developers at a conference recently saying that the reason Linux is being adopted in stock exchanges so much is because of its speed with delivering real-time messages. And they didn't care. The people who know about the Linux kernel speed compared to the speed of AIX don't care about the fact there's a penguin. So I think in enterprise users, it has reached that level.
Yeah, I think you look at, like, you know, FreeBSD, and it's got that cutesy little demon character, and FreeBSD is using some big rollouts, and OpenBSD as well is in some very serious kit, and that's got a pufferfish. And maybe in a way, you know, that says we're so sure of our product, we don't need to have a cube, you know, with a that looks like a fruit with a bite taken out of it, or some combination of logos. It's just, this is what we make.
It's interesting because me and Mike were talking the other day about logos and BASF, who used to make cassettes, and you say that they're actually a giant petrochemical firm.
Yeah, we saw that BASF is one of the biggest companies in the world, a massive German petrochemical company, and the only end consumer-facing product we ever saw was cassette tapes, and I think it was just an attempt to get their brand out into... Yeah. I used to see them in Woolworths, and I used to think, what do BASF make otherwise? And then years later, I looked them up, and they make, like, you know, massive polymers to build boats out of and stuff like that, so... They don't make any consumer-facing products.
Besides cassette tapes.
Yeah, and their logo was BASF, just a letter.
But it kind of suggests that maybe for the biggest companies to have their logo out there, so, you know, as MPs or other purchasing people who are making purchasing decisions, just to have kind of a subconscious awareness of a brand before coming into contact with it in a business sense situation is important.
You see, but that is, I think that is the problem from a graphical language point of view. On a marketing point of view, if you look at, I don't know, Ubuntu logo, or if you look at SUSE logo on a box, you don't straight, if you're not completely informed about Linux, you don't associate them with Linux straight away. Or you associate with Linux stocks. And even in media, if they're going to talk about, I don't know, comparisons between all the different operating systems, they will use stocks to compare against Apple or Windows. Mm-hmm. I think that is the problem, whether you like it, whether you like stocks or not, I think that's irrelevant. It's whether it's whether the penguin communicates what it's supposed to represent about.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
I don't think Tux is holding us back. I think Tux is an advantage that we've got a recognisable symbol that immediately says Linux to lots of people who don't know anything about Linux. I do think it's childish, and I am slightly embarrassed about it. I wish that something else had... Somebody had come up with something else. I mean, I'm not embarrassed about the penguin logo on penguin books. I like the way that that's done. And, you know... Maybe it's time that someone somewhere redesigns it in the same way Apple did with their old multicolored logo into their new platinum, whatever it is, logo. But you know, keep the same reference, but make it not quite so fat or smug.
Yeah.
Even Windows keeps revamping
their
own logo to modernize it.
Yeah, so there's no reason you can iterate on the logo and gradually shift it away from the childish.
Keep what people recognize. It's a penguin. Yeah. It's an operating system. It must be Linux.
Yeah,
put him in a suit.
like the Mandriva penguin. Hugh says, yes, no. It didn't stop me trying Linux, even though I think it's a really, really stupid logo for an OS. Linux Rich says, if a potential user can't see past our mascot, then do we really want them joining the fold?
No. Don't want to be part of our club.
Keep them out. Here's the chap who said that Tux was fat, Darcy Castleman. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a penguin mascot, but Tux needs a bit of a redesign. He's an overweight little fellow with what I've always felt was an air of insufferable smugness, which may be appropriate, but perhaps not the image we should be projecting.
Cool.
Maybe we should go back to having the GNU head then, because it's GNU/Linux. Yeah. Please continue your flame war in the comments, listeners.
I really like the idea of keep... I like the penguin. I think the penguin's cool, but I do like the idea of it getting tweaked and redesigned a little bit to just...
A penguin is you know, black and white. It looks good at small sizes. It's ideal for a logo, like you say, on penguin books, but the rendition of it that we've got is just looks so poor.
Yeah.
It looks terrible.
No offense to the person who designed it originally. Like, it was, I guess it came out in the 90s when kind of 3D, shiny computer generation.
But using the software at its disposal back in 1992
it fitted in with a cool, like, leading edge computer 3D graphic kind of look.
That would have looked awesome.
But it's not current anymore.
Yeah, now that the GIMP has got three more features since the 90s, it can do all sorts of new stuff.
My.
And with that, can we call the podcast to an end? I'm going to talk now and see if Mike's got one more thing.
I don't actually, so.
Okay, I'll try and think of something.
So, and with this, we come... I'm speaking slowly so Graham can do one more thing. Ein Student aus Uppsala, la 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 la. Ein Student aus Uppsala. Any luck?
I think that was good enough.
Oh, right. So, we will be back in 2 weeks to give you an update on our mesh network plan that John's going to make for us.
Yeah. I feel like nobody's going to like me in the office anymore.
No, but we're fine because you're going to do it. So, great. Have fun, everybody. Take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.